Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President distancing himself from his own appointment of Matthew Whitaker as the acting Attorney General by going out of his way to repeatedly claim he does not know Whitaker, even though they met frequently at the White House because Trump refused to meet with Whitaker's boss, Jeff Sessions, and instead dealt with the AG's Chief of Staff, Whitaker, who was deliberately installed at the Justice Department as the White House's eyes and ears. Lisa Graves, who has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, including as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts, joins us. We'll discuss Whitaker's role as a shill for a bottom-feeding invention promotion operation in Miami that scammed inventors, many of whom were veterans, which the FBI investigated, resulting in the company going out of business and paying fines. In both promoting the scam, then intimidating the victims who claimed they were ripped off by the scam, Whitaker used his credentials as a former U.S. attorney, and now as acting AG, he oversees the FBI, which investigated him. Then, with President Trump's cancellation on Saturday of his visit to a U.S. military cemetery in France to honor America's fallen in World War I, we will discuss the gathering of world leaders for the 100th anniversary of the armistice, at which the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, used the opportunity to denounce Trump's embrace of nationalism, describing nationalism as a, quote, betrayal of patriotism. Along with chauvinism, nationalism was an undeniable cause of World War I, in which 20 million died, half of whom were civilians, along with 117,000 Americans. Jeffrey Waro, a professor and the director of the Military History Center at the University of North Texas and the author of A Mad Catastrophe, The Outbreak of World War I and the Collapse of the Habsburg Empire, joins us to discuss whether the intellectually incurious Donald Trump, who gets a lot of his information from conspiracy sites like InfoWars, could be educated by his peers to accept the lessons of history. Then finally, we are joined in the studio by Talal Derki, a documentary filmmaker who was born in Damascus and has been based in Berlin since 2014. He joins us to discuss his new documentary feature just out of Fathers and Sons, which reveals how deeply rooted Salafist Islam practiced by Al-Qaeda and promoted by Saudi Arabia is in the lives of the father and sons facing death as their country, Syria, is destroyed. This powerful and important film brings a unique insight to Western audiences who for the first time will begin to understand what inspires and motivates jihadists to fight corrupt regimes in the Middle East and the U.S., which they see as the far enemy. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, the co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ian.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And since you were a deputy chief for the U.S. courts, I imagine it strikes you as a bit odd that the new acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker, doesn't believe in Marbury versus Madison, which is the foundation for judicial review. So I guess to his mind, much of your earlier career was in vain, right?
Well, it's shocking. You know, it's really a crackpot thing to say for this guy to have really challenged the most important, the most fundamental legal precedent in U.S. history, which is Marbury versus Madison. That is a settled law beyond settled law. That's core to our checks and balances and core to the interpretation of our Constitution. And so to have someone installed even temporarily at the head of the U.S. Department of Justice who has such a crackpot belief is shocking.
Well, his professional career, such as it is very, very much marred by recent revelations about his job that he had on the board of a scamming company down in Florida, an invention promotion company called World Patent Marketing. Thanks to the work of Brittany Seamus of the Miami New Times. They were able to obtain a letter from the FBI's victim specialists confirming that they were investigating the FBI up until recently. And the idea that the acting attorney general has been investigated by the FBI for fraud and now he's in charge of the FBI, those optics aren't too good.
Well, they're not good, and in fact, it's terrible. It both underscores how a completely shoddy and inept this White House is, the Trump White House is, at vetting of any kind. And also, it just shows how what happens when nepotism and loyalty overtake the rational process for staffing the top positions of our government. In this case, you have a firm that he was an advisor for that just this spring, not in the distant past, just this spring was subject to a multi-million dollar fine by the federal government for this as part of this fraud investigation and ongoing issues related to the victims of that company that was basically ripping off Americans who had the ingenuity, the desire to patent their inventions. These agencies, federal agencies, don't just go entering multi-million dollar fines for nothing. That was a serious set of issues. And he was an advisor at firm, but also, he has a checkered past in other ways. For example, he also, when he ran for the United States Senate in 2014 and lost to Joni Ernst in the primary in Iowa, he actually said at a public forum that if he were to become a senator, that he would impose a test on potential judicial nominees about whether they had a, quote, biblical view of justice. I don't know if that means stoning, eye for an eye, cutting off a hand, death for an array of offenses. But the fact is that our United States Constitution, from the very beginning of its passage in Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, has expressly forbidden there from being any religious test for office for the federal government in the United States. That was part of our founding fathers' determination, and it is unambiguous that any such test would be invalid, but this guy thinks that he can do whatever he wants, apparently.
Well, it's particularly disturbing that he worked for this bottom-feeding, scamming operation that ripped off veterans, I might add.
Right.
And he played a major role because he was brought in as a former U.S. attorney. They advertised that he was in their promotional videos, and apparently they just, pretended to help these people and did some mock-up drawings of their inventions, which one of the inventors said, his grandchild could have done a better job. It's pretty clear that they were just taking the money and running. And then when the ripped-off customers, the inventors who put up a bunch of money up front and got nothing in return, when they complained, Whitaker himself actually, using the fact that he's a former U.S. attorney, harassed these people and told them that he could come after them using the full weight of his experience as a U.S. attorney. So he was used, his credentials as a U.S. attorney were used to attract these investors who they ripped off. And then when the investors complained, he used his credentials as a former U.S. attorney to intimidate them.
That's exactly right, Ian, and it's so disturbing because, the weight of being a federal prosecutor and being a former federal prosecutor should not be deployed on behalf of a commercial enterprise and certainly not used to intimidate people who are making claims to a private entity. And I think that actually calls into question potential bar sanctions. If he had been, it's also a question of anyone who would be in any role at the Justice Department, an attorney role, who had done this previously, who had made those threats, who basically wait around to intimidate people who were making a complaint about a company. If they were to go through a background check for, for a new position and that came up, that would be a serious ethical issue of whether that person should be entrusted with any role, even the smallest, most entry-level role at the Justice Department, let alone to be at the top of it.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. Now, of course, when Trump was departing for the armistice 100-year memorial in France at the end of World War One in the Rose Garden, he took some questions and kept saying repeatedly, "I don't know Matthew Whitaker. I don't know Matthew Whitaker." And of course, the cable news people have managed to juxtapose him only a few weeks ago saying, "Oh, yes, I know Matthew Whitaker." So now he's trying to distance himself. I don't know whether that means that somebody's spoken to him saying this guy's an embarrassment. Maybe Rupert Murdoch or some of his friends that talk to him all the time on the phone have told him this is really pretty bad. I mean, it's the Wall Street Journal, incidentally, that has been breaking a lot of stories about how unqualified and how potentially corrupt this man is. So I don't know what's going on there. What do you think? Because the truth of the matter is that Trump was so mad at the Attorney General Jeff Sessions that this guy came over to the White House for meetings in Sessions' place because Trump simply didn't want him in the room. So Trump actually spent a lot of time with Whitaker.
Yeah, I mean, it's really shocking. I mean, in a way, I suppose it's not shocking that President Trump lied about this among the many lies that he issues on a sort of daily basis, but it is surprising because it's just wrong, and it's wrong, morally wrong. It's incorrect, according to what the public record shows. It's contradicted by his prior statements. It's contradicted by the statements of other people who've been at meetings involving Whitaker, involving Trump. It's really just so false. It's shocking that he thinks that he can get away with this continued sort of falsity in the face of evidence. But when you think about Whitaker as well, you know, he was a U.S. attorney for the District of Iowa. But, you know, I worked on some of those U.S. attorney nominations when I was at the Senate Judiciary Committee. And quite frankly, we had a situation where we really could not stop any of Bush's U.S. attorney nominees during that period. We were busy trying to protect the courts for lifetime appointments. And the U.S. attorney position, as important as it is, was one that was a temporary position for that post in a state like Iowa or somewhere else. There was no way we were going to be able to filibuster those nominees when we had such a battle with the Republicans over some of these most extreme people who were being nominated for the federal bench, for the circuit court. And so the fact that he had that credential in the past, that it was approved, quote, unanimously, was just a sign, unfortunately, of us not being able to stop those lower-level appointees from those positions. But in this instance, with Whitaker, I think you do see the president apparently trying to distance himself from him. But it's also quite clear that he was chosen because of his antagonism toward Sessions, and more importantly, chosen because of his antipathy toward Mueller and the investigation, his statements on CNN, which were basically designed to get him a job within the administration, criticizing the investigation, claiming there was no evidence, echoing President Trump. And so on that point, it's even more extraordinary and outlandish for this person to be given this role. It really is a coup at the Department of Justice to have this person installed unilaterally by the president without Senate consent, without any real vetting, and who has such serious clouds hanging over him based on his past statements, including crackpot statements.
So it's clear that Whitaker did audition, and basically he was on CNN only interested in an audience of one. And we know that Trump spends most of his working day watching television. In fact, he admitted the other day when he attacked a African-American female journalist in the Rose Garden, when he was basically saying, "I never heard of this guy. Who is Matthew Whitaker? No, I don't know him. I don't know him." It was at that moment that he was asked whether or not this was a precursor for firing Mueller. And he just said that was a stupid question, and he attacked this journalist. But he did tweet out, Trump, that Leonard Leo of the Federal Society was among the people who thought very highly of Whitaker and recommended him to him. That's pretty extraordinary. We know that Leonard Leo has brought us Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. What's he doing bringing us this guy? What is he trying to do apart from stack the Supreme Court with far right-wing, deeply fundamentalist Catholic jurists?
Well, I'm so glad you raised that, because the role of Leonard Leo, who is a longtime vice president of the Federal Society, who played a key role, was basically delegated the role of choosing and recommending to the president who should become a Supreme Court justice, to have his fingerprints on this appointment, this effort to get a yes man in over at the Justice Department, in spite of the legal requirements for being attorney general, including the nomination and advising to the Senate, is really extraordinary. I think it exposes the depth to which Leonard Leo is going to try to manipulate our government. He's an unelected person. He's never run for office. He has no consent of the people for the extraordinary role that he's playing in our government, the gamesmanship he's playing with our United States Supreme Court, the secretive efforts of the Federal Society in terms of the way that they've been grooming people to become judges. And also Leonard Leo's role in fundraising for dark money operations like the Judicial Crisis Network, which spent millions of dollars in the last 3 years basically trying to block Merrick Garland from being confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was Obama's nominee, trying to make sure that Neil Gorsuch was confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court, to that seat that was vacated upon the death of Justice Scalia, and to backstop Brett Kavanaugh at this crucial moment earlier this fall when serious allegations, including my allegations of Brett Kavanaugh's lying under oath, arose, as well as the very serious allegations and evidence that was provided by Christine Blasey Ford and more about Kavanaugh. And so you have someone who is instrumental in the dark money effort to try to influence and distort our courts, who has now been involved in selecting someone who is manifestly unfit, who has radical, reactionary, extremist views about our Constitution, into a role, even temporarily, as the head of the Justice Department. It's unacceptable and it's outrageous.
So let's turn a little to the questions that I think are on a lot of people's mind, and that is, it's pretty transparent that this character, one, auditioned for the job, or to get Trump's attention by attacking Mueller. And then he gets the job. The White House engineers the appointment of him to become the chief of staff of Jeff Sessions, who was, you know, pretty much in Siberia as far as the White House is concerned. And he becomes the White House's eyes and ears. And now, thanks to Leonard Leo and others, he's now promoted as acting attorney general. And a lot of people think that his real job is, in fact, that was the question that was asked of Trump when he dissed this African-American reporter from CNN. Was basically, is he in there to get rid of the special counsel, Mueller? There was an expectation that on Friday that there'd be some indictments coming down, including Don Jr., who apparently Donald Trump Jr. has told his friends that he expects to be indicted. Is there any chance that Whitaker, his first act, because apparently Mueller meets with Rosenstein every Friday to update him on where things are. Is it possible that Whitaker was in on that meeting? Is it possible that there were indictments that have been already stalled? Or do you think that Whitaker has not yet corralled Mueller?
Well, it's not clear, and we don't know who was in those meetings or would be in those meetings. Given his statements before being tasked by Trump to come in to take this post, it seems clear that his intention, certainly Trump's intention, is for him to shut down this investigation, to obstruct this investigation, which is precisely why Trump was so furious with Sessions, that he did not obstruct this investigation and shut it down. We don't know yet if there's been any impact on that special counsel investigation, whether it has slowed or changed the course of that lawful, legitimate, very serious investigation surrounding President Trump and his family and his closest advisors. I would say that if that were the effect, I think that would be potentially another count of obstruction by this president, and potentially by Matthew Whitaker himself, to try to limit the ability of the Justice Department through Robert Mueller to pursue a lawful investigation into criminal activity, serious criminal activity by this president or the president's closest advisors about a number of issues that affect both our national security and our domestic security and the enforcement of our laws in this country. The president is not above the law. Matthew Whitaker is not above the law. And I think that in interference in this investigation by this, in essence, almost usurper in Whitaker, really exposes further potential of criminal liability as John Mitchell and Richard Kleindienst faced perhaps for their role in aiding Nixon when he, during those scandals of that period. So if Matthew Whitaker doesn't recognize the legal risk that he himself may be facing by being by potentially trying to shut this investigation down under these circumstances, then he's even a worse lawyer than he appears based on his past statements.
So just in closing, do you think that if Whitaker tried to put to lean on Mueller, Mueller could just say, well, I'm insulated, and furthermore, we're not even sure that you're constitutionally legitimate. I mean, I'm hearing reports that the rank and file inside the Justice Department are just appalled by this guy. The idea that he's been under FBI investigation and the investigation by the U.S. Postal Service for fraud or aiding and abetting fraud, that's bad enough. But apparently he was shameless in trying to lobby for Rosenstein's job before he got the top job.
Well, you know, this is a situation where the United States Constitution sets forth the rules for who can become a principal officer of the federal government. And those rules require the advice and consent of the Senate. And so a number of scholars have pointed out that in their view, and I share that view, that this appointment is unlawful and illegitimate. The question of what happens next is in some ways the big question. Would Mueller have the ability to challenge any determination to end the investigation or to try to chill the investigation, drive the investigation, or limit the funds for that investigation? That's unclear. The status of the power of the judge presiding over the grand jury in D.C., as well as the judge presiding over the grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia, that both of which have been involved in this case, their power to protect that investigation and protect the case from potential witness tampering or other inappropriate activity that would limit the course of this investigation, their power to perhaps protect the investigation is unclear. The power of United States senators and House of Representatives members to file a suit, perhaps to intervene if that were to happen, or to try to remove Whitaker because of this improvident appointment is unclear. And also, just on Friday, a group that I'm on the advisory board of, Free Speech for People, filed a letter with the Justice Department, with Rod Rosenstein, asking for him to seek a writ quo warranto under the District of Columbia's rules that allow for there to be a challenge to someone who is acting as a federal officer unlawfully without an appropriate appointment. And they reserve the right in that letter to seek that writ on behalf of the American people if Rod Rosenstein feels that he cannot due to the pressure that he's under. So there are a number of options. We'll see what happens next, but this is uncharted territory. It's unprecedented. I think it's unconstitutional. It's a threat to the rule of law, and it's really an extraordinary outrage for our country, our democracy, to be facing these self-inflicted wounds by this president who's acting like a scared animal, a cornered animal, lashing out and trying to protect himself and perhaps his son and his friends and his future from criminal liability that he may well be very much embroiled in.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back discussing the gathering of world leaders on this 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, today being Armistice Day, at which the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, used the opportunity to denounce Trump's embrace of nationalism, describing nationalism as a betrayal of patriotism.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual friend.
This is a war we can't win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died. died at the end. So who's going to account for these things? And I don't.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeffrey Wiro, professor and the director of the Military History Center at the University of North Texas. He's the author of A Mad Catastrophe, The Outbreak of World War I and the Collapse of the Habsburg Empire, and most recently, Sons of Freedom, The Forgotten American Soldiers Who Defeated Germany in World War I. And he has an article at the Wall Street Journal, The Reinvention of Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Wiro.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jeffrey. And there's been quite a bit of controversy about President Trump canceling a visit to a U.S. military cemetery on Saturday because of the rain. This prompted Britain's defense minister to say rain did not prevent our brave heroes from doing their job. That is a pretty extraordinary act on the part of the president. And, of course, on top of that, there's a prickly relationship with the French President Macron, who is hosting all of these world leaders attending the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I and the signing of the armistice. And, of course, it seems as though Macron took a swipe at President Trump by castigating the notion of nationalism. And clearly, as an historian, Jeffrey, surely nationalism and chauvinism were largely the causes of World War I.
Yeah, I mean, now there's a lot of things wrong with canceling the visit to Belleau Wood and the and Marne Cemetery and not going out to see the larger cemetery for the Meuse-Argonne. But this is where we are. This is how the United States president rolls in such things. And so none of this seems amiss to him, I'm sure. But yes, to your larger question, it is a question of burying this kind of America First nationalism or German alternative for republic nationalism and knitting ourselves back into these multinational organizations and being a leader, not a follower or a absconder, and really rallying with our vital allies and not stepping out of line in Paris to shake Vladimir Putin's hand. It was like as if Woodrow Wilson had lauded Vladimir Lenin in 1917 instead of supporting the provisional government of Kerensky and who were looking for a real parliamentary democracy. So yeah, there's a lot of things wrong, and this is an occasion to try to do what's right.
Well, of course, when you mention Putin, he seems to be dedicated to undermining the West and the Western alliance and the European Union by supporting far right-wing nationalist parties. So isn't that a case of the lines being pretty stark there at the gathering of these world leaders?
Yeah, I mean, it's very stark. And, this is ultimately symbolic. We are talking about a war that ended 100 years ago, but this was a war that, taught powerful lessons about, the lure of nationalism, but the dangers of nationalism and the much greater power of coalitions. When coalitions unite together to work together to solve problems and to, defeat nefarious enemies and, bring peace and democracy, and it works, but it has to be worked at. And, so I think this is what Macron was trying to do. France has obviously declined from the standing it had in 1918, but France still, powerfully trumpets this message of European unity as opposed to the disunity that is spreading there. And this is an opportunity for the United States to really, insert itself back into this multinational alliance, NATO, and to support for the European Union, work in sensible ways to, bring this coalition back and, revive some of the strength that we saw 100 years ago when we were faced with a really colossal test.
Well, at the beginning of Trump's visit, actually before he left, he tweeted out an attack. I actually think the minute he arrived on French soil, he tweeted out an attack on Macron, who had made a statement about the need for the French and the Germans and the British and other Western European countries to form a European army. And that seems to have gotten under Trump's skin. I think they kind of worked it out, the two leaders, subsequently, because there was that sort of photo op where Macron patted Trump on the knee and basically said, we were actually talking about burden sharing. And, of course, Trump has complained that NATO, he complains about it being a freeloader and has never forcefully or even ritually supported and reinforced the Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which means that all nations come to the defense of a NATO country that's attacked. That was employed after 9/11, and to this day, NATO soldiers are in Afghanistan alongside American soldiers. So Article 5 has actually been invoked to defend the United States from being attacked, but Trump has never done the reverse.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know who briefs the president. I'm sure he is briefed, but I'm sure he doesn't listen to the briefings, because this whole Euro Army business was hashed out back when they, you know, basically 20 years ago. And, the United States supported a European force to, you know, as a spur to increase spending and, you know, so that they could partner with us in big ventures, you know, with big, you know, resources. And so now he's looking at this as being something that's aimed at the United States. And it's clearly not. And it's an effort by Macron and the others to have greater unity in all areas. And so, you know, it's just more of this sort of bungling, amateurish policy by the president and, you know, posturing for his base instead of being a world leader, instead of being a national leader. You know, he's a leader of 35% of the country, and these are sort of red meat lines that I guess play well, although I don't know to the extent that people even understand this issue, really. But again, it was a missed opportunity to, you know, look at Western interests and how best to support Western interests and how best to project power when needed and, you know, with the right kind of, you know, interlinked resources. And just, you know, he just took it as a challenge, rather than seeing it as a good opportunity to strengthen Western defense.
Well, of course, in terms of Putin, he has found a way to essentially conduct a form of hybrid warfare beneath the threshold of what they call kinetic warfare, which is what clearly ground on for 4 years in the mud in Flanders Fields, etc., where a whole generation of young men essentially died because of a squabble amongst pretty much the same ruling royal dynasties. That, of course, has always struck me as the extraordinary irony. But you've written a book about the beginning of World War I, in your book, A Bad Catastrophe, the outbreak of World War I and the collapse of the Habsburg Empire. So I guess two questions there. Let's start with the historical one and then with the contemporary one. Do you agree with that idea that this was an amazing situation in which a whole generation of young men were just mowed down on both sides because of a squabble amongst European aristocrats?
Yeah, no, I just think that obviously the great powers were spoiling for a conflict. There was war guilt on all sides. There was an aggressive plan by the German Austrians to win a war before, you know, they were sort of overtaken by big Russian and French military buildups. So, you know, there was that. But then there was just a series of accidents where, you know, people overreached, as in this Austrian ultimatum to the Serbs that then bring in the Russians, that bring in the Germans, that bring in the French, that, you know, turn it into a world war involving 32 nations. So, you know, it just, you know, calls for calm and sensible policy. And I think we're getting that out of people like Macron or Merkel. And we're seeing an American president who doesn't realize the gravity of these things and the really major risks and dangers that they pose. So this is a time for this 100th anniversary, the end of World War I, is a time for serious reflection about all of these issues.
Well, just on the other question, just in closing, this hybrid warfare that Putin is conducting is beneath the threshold of active, what they call kinetic warfare. And we don't even know the extent to which Trump has been manipulated or even co-opted in Putin's efforts to meddle in Western European affairs, exploit divisions within these Western democracies, including our own, and essentially do a lot of damage.
Yeah, well, and remember, hybrid warfare was practiced 100 years ago when, you know, the Russians or the Austrians would use militias and bombs to ignite little crises so they could expand their interests. So it's not entirely new, but it does pose a real threat, and it there's no great mystery to it. I mean, hybrid warfare was, you know, successfully used in Crimea, in eastern Ukraine, and Georgia, and places like that, and so we know what it looks like. We know exactly what's going on. It's just a president who chooses not to see because of his own involvement behind the scenes with Russians. So, I mean, there's no great mystery here, and there's no great, we shouldn't deceive ourselves as to the risk, because if we don't take this seriously, if we don't draw a line, then it continues to be crossed and continues to provoke crises that are going to be far more consequential than what we've seen thus far.
But just in closing, if we have a president who divides us, it divides American against American, and that you, of course, recall the famous adage of Abraham Lincoln, a house divided against itself cannot stand. It seems as though President Trump himself, he talks about the press as the enemy of the people. I mean, in many ways, his behavior could be construed as being the enemy of the American people.
Yeah, well, it's somebody who we've never seen this before. We've always seen a president come in and attempt to unite and expand their footprint and reach across lines to have a bigger coalition. And instead, we have somebody who's made a very narrow decision to excite the base and turn it out enough base and to work the Electoral College and hang on to the Senate, which is a vestige of times when small states had to be coaxed into a union with the big states, and so the Senate in no way reflects the share of opinion in the country, nor does the Supreme Court for that matter. So he's someone who's taken a very cynical view about the whole thing, and trying to exploit some of the weaknesses in the federal system, which were once seen as strengths and still could be strengths if we had a sort of wise, mature, and statesman-like leader, but that we don't. So he is deliberately dividing the House against himself in order to prolong his own political fortunes. But this is, again, something that has to be handled, dealt with through the democratic process, and I have no doubt it will be. It's just unfortunate and exposes the United States to a fair amount of risk in the meantime.
Well, Jeffrey Warrow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Adrian, thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Warrow, who's a professor and the director of the Military History Center at the University of North Texas. He's the author of A Mad Catastrophe, The Outbreak of World War I and the Collapse of the Habsburg Empire, and most recently, Sons of Freedom, The Forgotten American Soldiers Who Defeated Germany in World War I. And he has an article at the Wall Street Journal, The Reinvention of Warfare. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by the filmmaker of the stunning new feature documentary just out of Fathers and Sons. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Talal Derki, a documentary filmmaker who was born in Damascus and has been based in Berlin since 2014. Before making his own films, he worked as an assistant director on many feature films and as a director of various Arab TV programs and as a freelance cameraman for CNN and Thomson Reuters. His short films and feature-length documentaries have received many festival prizes, including the Grand Jury Prize for World Documentaries for both Return to Homs and his latest film, Just Out of Fathers and Sons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Talal Derki.
Thank you.
So, Talal, this is, of course, Armistice Day, commemoration of the end of World War I, which ended 100 years ago to this day. And one of the extraordinary things about the portrayal of the father and sons who were fighting against the Assad regime, they are fighting for al-Qaeda, they keep talking. The father keeps talking about Armageddon, the endless war. The war, he keeps saying, this war will go on and on and on and on, and he's but a small part in this war, and he doesn't mind dying, and he doesn't mind that his young sons, who were like 10 years old, some of them, doesn't mind them dying either. So this is an amazing insight into a world that we don't understand and an enemy that we've been fighting since the so-called War on Terror, starting from September the 11th, 2011.
Yeah. I mean, we all have, and even for us, like, we try to understand, because when it's all started in 2011, it had a background as a revolution seeking for freedom and changing and democracy. And slowly, slowly, it's been stolen by all those jihadist groups. Since it's become military, like after a few months. So it's important to know from inside the society, this what I believe in. What is their motivation? What is the key? How they brainwash societies? What happened to the new generation? How they grow up? And who are those? And what their background? In order to understand more this ideology. And to, because they are, it's an illness. So you need really to know more about it and to find the right
solution.
So this is what I decide, because I'm from the same country. I have an access from my previous film to be there. I know a lot of people on the ground. So in the time that most half of the Syrian become refugees outside of the country, running away from the war, all those jihadi fighters, they came to Syria. Some of them, Assad released a lot of them from the prison. In Abu Ghraib, they released all those leaders of Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra. They were in Abu Ghraib and Saidnaya prisons. And they released in 2011 and 2013. So
the Americans released them?
No. The governments in Syria and Iraq.
Oh, but why would the Iraqi government release them?
The both government. They take this advice from Iran that to confuse the situation. So release those terrorists and say that and make it like more a war against terrorists instead of people say that you kill your own people. You can say, only fight.
Right,
the radical people on the ground. So it's a start. It's a start in this way. Then the borders is open, like the Turkish border open for them, and they crossed thousands of them with their families. They came from all around the world, and I don't know if that was the decision of many, like globally, that the Syria should be the better field, the place where they should put all of those people there instead of the mountains of Afghanistan and all of this. So for us, for me as a Syrian, I mean, I don't have a religion background in a way, so I grow up more like in a secular...
Kurdish, you are.
I'm a Kurdish also, so... Mm. So I went there with a camera and I pretend to be a jihadist in a way with a camera, sympathy with the jihad, like all of those who arrived to Syria.
There's no way that you could have done what you did without appearing to be
sympathetic. Exactly, they would cut my head. I mean, they are really bloody people.
Oh, you can tell. But when you say the film is a diagnosis of this illness. You say it's an illness. Mm-hmm. I've never seen it more clearly portrayed and understood of how these people are motivated and inspired by. This guy calls his children.
Exactly. Is the process how the father and the adults, the society, the jihad, how they brainwash
the kids. Oh, it's shocking.
So because those kids, they grow up in a war zone since 8 years and they don't have any background except war. Yeah. So you can imagine what kind of women they can be.
Right. No, you see that. You see that in the fact that the kids fight amongst themselves. They throw stones at the girls. There are no women in this film.
No woman is not allowed to appear in front of the camera. Right. This is the worst thing can happen from the history of my country. It can happen to the woman and to the female. It's happening right now.
Right. And again, I'm joined in the studio by Talal Derki. He's a documentary filmmaker born in Damascus. He's been based in Berlin since 2014. His extraordinary new film, just out, is of Fathers and Sons. It opens next Friday in New York, and it opens here in Los Angeles on Friday, November the 23rd, at the Lemley Music Hall. The Turks let them in, the jihadis from Europe, in because Erdogan hated Assad. They were friends, and then he felt betrayed by him. And the Saudis emptied their jails and let their jihadists come in as well.
Yeah.
So in the opening, I pointed out that this is a portrayal of a father and sons who are basically captured by the Salafist or
jihadi movement.
Yeah. Which is – been propagated, promoted by the Saudis, which is amazing.
Not only Saudis.
No, but Wahhabi Islam is pretty close.
Mostly like, yeah.
Yeah. So is there any understanding about how Islam has to reform itself? It has to go against takfir. It has to say takfir is heresy.
One character in the film mentioned, the uncle of the kids, he mentioned that the village before the war, it was Sufist. It's the modern Islam which against violence.
Right.
They are open to all religions.
Right.
And he said, now, thank God, there is no any more Sufi.
Right.
They all become Salafist.
Right.
And
but
this is
drove
not
them
only
out or they converted them. Did they drive them away or did they convert them?
Like a lot of people who refused to be in this circumstance, in this new condition, they left.
Right.
And they become refugees.
I see.
And those who didn't have choice or those who want to be already, they believe in this new movement, they are still there. So in a way that... It's for me, this big tragedy, it's big disaster that more like what's happened to this area, how they moved to be radical and extremist.
Right. Well, the Taliban, of course, their first target was the Sufis as well. And it's the same with the Pakistan Taliban. SWAT Valley, that's the number one enemy.
You go to the film, it's not about Syria itself. It's about the Salafist movement. It's about the radicalism. You can look at this film as it's in Iraq, as it's Afghanistan or Libya or Yemen. They are all the same.
Right.
And they say caliphate. Which is a political system,
right.
Belong to the even in Muhammad time there wasn't caliphate. He didn't establish caliphate.
Right, right. No, it's that's what's so revealing about it is how their world is completely circumscribed, and how these kids are brainwashed and they are sent first to Sharia school, and then to military training. And there's a frightening scene where they're pulling out these tiny little uniforms. So these kids are, about 10 years old?
10 years, 11, 12, 14.
Right.
And then they become like in 15, they become, I guess, a real fighter in al-Nusra army and other. So it's not only al-Nusra. There are a lot of radical group with the different titles, but they all... They want caliphate, they want Sharia,
Well, they don't know anything else, do they?
No.
They've grown up, you see these kids growing up with war, you can hear the bombs and the shells in the background all day long. And the father is a mind clearer. He's clearing minds.
He worked with the exclusive stuff.
Yeah,
he's responsible for a bomb happened in Damascus 2008.
He's the bomb maker.
Yeah, so... And he died from his work. He died in the 17th of October, this October.
Just
while
recently.
While he dismantling a bomb car. So what he do is return to him,
Wow, that's poetic justice.
There's a moment like a big block in the film where he faced similar story, but he didn't killed. He didn't die in that moment. He just lost his feet.
Right.
So, but you know what kind of? So they worship death. They said they worship God. No, they worship death.
They do. They talk about death all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that this war will go on
forever. They suck for death. They say this life for them is a bridge to be shahid, martyr. So
right.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where he's talking to his friends about how he wants to have more sons with more wives in order to feed the jihad.
Yeah. Exactly. The all will be like soldiers of the upcoming caliphate.
Uh-huh.
He believed this is kind of the mythology behind
right, but,
the.
But you sensed a sickness, and it was pretty clear, yeah. And you've diagnosed it clearly. Anybody that sees this film really understands what this is about.
Yeah.
But what's the cure? What's the cure?
What is
the cure? How do you how do you cure this sickness? How do you stop?
I mean, it's there are many steps we have to do it seriously. First of all, they should in all like Muslims country, I mean, United Nations should do that. Mm-hmm. America, people have power, all those big organizations, UNICEF, etc. They should first stop teaching religion in school. There should be a strict law that kids. Anyone harm a kid
right.
in school or at house should go to the bully. There should be a strict law about that. This is a red line because it's in the culture. They said the stick is a piece of beast from the paradise,
right.
Which means that you have to harm your kid wherever he don't pray or right. do whatever. So if there is a strict law that parents. They're not allowed to harm their kids and the society grow up in peaceful atmosphere. Right. I believe then if something, there will not be a civil war. The jihadists will not find anyone to follow them because right. people inside themselves, they are against violence.
Right. Well, that's why you've got to, we have an alliance with Saudi Arabia and this Trump. No. He's obviously defending MBS, who's clearly a murderer, because there's a money
selfish,
relationship.
I mean. Yeah,
but the price we pay for turning a blind eye to Saudi Arabia, you know, Indonesia, which has had a very peaceful form of Islam, is now in the process of being transformed into radicalism because of the schools, the madrasas that the Saudis first started in Afghanistan, then in Pakistan. And
so I was witness. I mean, there was a group of moderate fighters in Syria, north of Syria. Mm. I was there when Al-Qaeda attacked this group because this group, the leader of this group was responsible of arresting most of the ISIS leaders.
Right.
And al-Nusra want to get revenge for their friendship. And they attack his group and Turkey ask him to surrender. And they take all their weapons.
Right.
So these weapons come from Europe and America. So you can know how they can finance themselves. So
sure. Well, there's a scene in the movie where you ask him, the main character, the bomb maker, with the sons, who he's. You ask him, what's the difference between Al Qaeda and ISIS? And he said, well, one is an obedient son, and one is not.
Yeah.
Which one do you choose? You know. I mean, that's a pretty...
That's what he chose. He chose the obedient one to Al-Qaeda, which is al-Nusra, because they take the order from Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Who he calls one of his sons, Ayman.
Yeah, and because al-Nusra tried to not publish things that make more enemies, they still work behind, from down to down, you know, until the moment they can establish their power... And they can declare the Sharia on the ground.
Right. Well, all his kids are named after the Al Qaeda leaders, including
Osama. So all his he named. So this is also one of the tragedy that those kids, his kids, they don't have a choice. Since the moment they're born, the father named them with the names of Al Qaeda leaders. So that means they have to be exactly. Right. As what their name. So Osama, he didn't want to be. He want to run from the military, the Sharia camp, and this is clear in many scenes.
You see the horrible guy
and he was crying. He was afraid because they were shooting between his legs, and he want to run back to his mom in the village, but they forced him to stay. So and slowly he get used to the situation. And we lost him. He's not anymore that innocent boy.
Right. And where are these kids today?
I don't know about them. I mean, since I left, I returned back to my life, and they said the blaze end, and I blocked all those accounts. And I get now a lot of threats since my first interview from the family and from the society, and they promised me They said, we're going to meet you soon.
They're going to kill
and
you.
They said that you are part of the conspiracy about our religion. So,
right.
But
right.
They are not the religion. They are they are the illness of the religion.
Right. So you're a heretic and you've been marked for death.
I have to be careful where I travel, where I live. So, but anyway, this is nothing comparing of being there.
Right.
Like being here or in Europe.
Well, that's what's amazing about your film, that you've taken this risk to tell us about what's going on. And they should show this film everywhere in America instead of this.
Hope so. I mean, it's really important to. So this is the first film from inside, from really deep focus in about the society, the education. Right. There's no violence in there. There's no direct violence.
I know.
It's in the brain.
You can see this that. There's a
from
scene
the first
where the father,
scene when they slide the bird, when he teach them how to slide the bird. So from the beginning, you can understand that this is psychological trip inside the jihadi movement brain.
Well, I think you also show this terrifying scene where these soldiers are captured, Assad's regime soldiers, and they're lined up in a courtyard.
This is exactly what I was talking about, First World War. This is an image remind us of the Holocaust, of all those people who get arrested, who get killed, who starved during the...
So you have the Al-Qaeda flag behind them. They're lined up.
This is in the main prison of Al-Qaeda.
And these poor guys, one of the soldiers said he tried to defect, and he really wants to be... You know, exonerated.
He tried to survive.
You didn't show them being killed, which happened later.
You just show them literally waiting to die. The image telling, like, we go very, very deep inside their suffering. You can look at their face. You can see the tears
coming down his eyes just as he's contemplating his death. And these guys are casual. The killers, the Al-Qaeda guys, it's like another day at the office. Yeah. They're completely... spilling blood. There's a scene where they slaughter a calf, too.
Yeah.
It's so familiar. So
this is about sacrifice. So the father, this is also part from the film, the paradox, like how you love, you see how he
loves his children,
like every father.
Yeah.
At the same time, he sent them to in a war, and they are not yet teenagers. So this is a sacrifice. This is what he was talking about. He needs to sacrifice.
Right. And they, will...
And for him, it's fine. He have a 12. She have two wives. He can have four even. Mm-hmm. So then every year he can have more and more. This will never end. We don't want this war to end. This is the point.
No, that's clear. I thank you so much. We could talk on for a long time, but I've been speaking with Talal Derki, a documentary filmmaker who's born in Damascus, has been based in Berlin since 2014. And before making his own films, he worked as an assistant director on many feature films, a director for various Arab TV programs, and as a freelance cameraman for CNN and Thomson Reuters. And his short films and feature-length documentaries have received many festival prizes, including the Grand Jury Prize for World Documentary for both Return to Homs and his latest film, Just Out, of Fathers and Sons, which opens in New York next Friday, November the 16th, and in Los Angeles on Friday, November the 23rd at the Lemley Music Hall. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.